Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Radio Solar System. I've got a full mug of coffee in front of me, so hopefully I'll make it through what is actually one of the shorter classes in the course without too much of an incident. So, at this point, we're concluding up, we're finishing up Module 3. In the first part of this module, we talked a little bit about the history of observations, very early observations of the solar system, obvious motions that we could see, our ancestors could see very easily, and talked about some of the explanations for why these motions occur, in particular things like eclipses of the moon and various other aspects like the phases of the moon, the length of the day, the seasons, and all these things. And then we went on to talk a little bit about some of the methods that we now use today in our modern era to examine the solar system and the cosmos as a whole. So what we're going to do in this next class is move ahead to talk a little bit about the wider context of the solar system within the galaxy and the universe. So this is like the regional setting of where we are. What is the solar system and where is it located within the universe? What is its context within the galaxy and the universe? So we're going to be taking quite a long excursion through space and time, at least in the first part of the class. So let's have a look at the agenda for today. As always, The hint to change the slides will be indicated by a distinctive sound. So if we take a look now at the plan for today, I want to talk a little bit about the context of the solar system within the universe, a few ideas about the origin and development of the universe, not great detail about this, and also the concept of the expanding universe, which is part of this. I want to say a little bit about how we understand distances to the stars, how we actually measure things within the galaxy and outside the galaxy, and also about the sizes and temperatures of stars and the variation among them. Stars are not all the same. There are good stars and there are bad stars, at least from a planetary perspective. There are very good places to have a planet and very bad places to have a planet. And then we'll finish up this class with a review of the essential components of the solar system and an introduction to some concepts of scale within the solar system as well. So there's quite a bit of stuff to cover, but this particular class is one of the shorter ones in the course, which I'm sure you'll be glad to hear. So let's move along and have a look at the next one. Well, you've seen this slide before. I think the orientation was different when I used it before. This is the photograph from Voyager when it's on its way out of the solar system and towards the end of the last century, and Earth is that tiny bluish dot in the lower part of the photograph. So it's pretty hard to find us, even when you're just on the edge of our own solar system. So it goes without saying that the Earth is not very significant on the scale of the solar system, and it's not very significant on the scale of the universe too. And we will discover this in many different ways today. So let's move along. What about the beginning of the universe? Well, there's a lot of stuff to talk about for the origin of the universe and its early evolution. And most of these things are actually really hard for many of us to visualize. And that includes me too. They come from the work of people who are cosmologists, if you like, and theoretical physicists. There's a lot of esoteric mathematics in some of this work. So we're not going to spend much time talking about this because I think we all recognize that some of it does kind of stretch our comprehension and our ability to understand things. But let's just get a few things straight, a few major points. The universe is estimated to have formed about 13.7 billion years ago, 13.7 GA. Now, prior to that time, cosmologists believed that all the mass and all the energy in the universe, which is truly immense, was contained within a single infinitely small point. And that's a little hard to visualize. And the Big Bang, as it's called, is the initial incredibly fast expansion of the universe in the first very short period of time. And that expansion continues today. What is the future of the universe? Well, there are differences amongst physicists as to what its future is. The only thing they're sure of is that it's a very, very long way in the future. Some people believe that it will eventually recollapse into something back into another singular point called the Big Crunch. Now, whether that will happen or not, I can't really comment. Some people think that the universe will continue to expand. This is a realm that we're not going to spend a lot of time discussing because it's really at the edge of the agenda for our own course. So let's move along and just have a visual look at this. So this is slide 5 now. So once upon a time, all that mass and energy was packed into one point, and it exploded, and it's been expanding ever since. Now the universe is unimaginably huge. The dimensions of the universe are not really known with certainty. But it's not unimaginably all because it does have a beginning, because we can reconstruct that expansion and arrive back at the point when everything comes together. So we do have a fairly good idea of the age of the universe. Galaxies and stars didn't really form within the first billion years or so in the universe. First billion years or so is pretty much what we call the Dark Ages, because that matter didn't really exist. Our solar system formed at about 4.6 billion years ago, so it's about one third of the total age of the universe. So let's just move along and have a look at this in a slightly different way. Those early times would have been very alien to us. Stars and galaxies began to form within about the first billion years. So the universe today is similar in general terms to what's existed for about 12 billion years, aside from its size. The universe has had galaxies, it's had stars, and presumably it's had planetary systems since very early in its history as well. Right? But the universe is expanding. The size of the universe is growing. And this is the concept of the expanding universe, which is demonstrated in the next slide, which is really the same thing, shown in a slightly different way. There are some terms in here that we're not going to talk about in any kind of detail. We're not going to talk about dark energy, accelerated expansion, or any of these things. These are things that are well outside our agenda for this particular course. But keep this bigger picture in mind. Now, the concept of the expanding universe was really the work of one particular astronomer whose name is attached to it, and also to a lot of other things too. So let's go to the next slide. This is Edwin Hubble. And Edwin Hubble is often referred to as the father of cosmology. And he was one of the first people to discover galaxies that existed beyond our own, because they weren't known in the early days of astronomy. And he really established the size of the universe. But what he's best known for is the concept of the expanding universe. And he did this by using a thing that we call the Doppler effect. And we're going to talk about this in a later session in the course. This is how we use spectroscopy, shifts in the wavelengths of emitted radiation from moving objects, to figure out how fast they're moving. And what Hubble showed was that other galaxies that he could examine were moving away from us, and that the further they were away from us, the faster they were moving. He was able to demonstrate this by using the Doppler effect to show their velocities. And this relationship, of course, turns out to be a linear one when you plot it in the right way. So there you see it. That's the relationship there. The light that comes from distant galaxies is affected as a consequence of their motion speed. And this is a bit like how the sound of a vehicle will change pitch when it passes you. If a vehicle goes past you, its engine sounds different when it moves away from you than when it moves towards you. And that's a way of estimating velocity. And we use this method extensively in planetary science to find out when things are moving and what direction they're moving in. We can estimate distance using other methods, and we can find a linear relationship between the distance and the velocity. So that's the concept of the expanding universe. Now, if you want to visualize that a little bit better, there's a simple analogy that's very popular and very effective. So let's look at the next slide. This is the balloon analogy. If you imagine inflating a balloon progressively, if that balloon has a number of individual spots on the surface of the balloon, as that balloon gets bigger, those spots are further and further away from one another. And if they had spots inside the balloon, that would also apply to those too. So that's the analogy that's used for the expanding universe. It's getting bigger, and everything is getting further apart as a result. So let's move along now and ask if we can prove any of this stuff. Well, I can't prove it all to you today, okay? And I'm not a cosmologist or a theoretical physicist. But let's just say that the expanding universe does fit with the concept of the Big Bang. It doesn't actually prove it in the right sense, okay? How do we make chemical elements? What about the chemical elements that exist throughout the universe? Well, the most abundant elements, of course, are the lighter elements. To make these, we need some sort of a process of nuclear fusion. We need to be able to take simple elements and fuse them together to make heavier elements. And that demands very extreme conditions. It can't happen without extreme temperatures and pressures. The heavier elements are formed within stars. The abundances of light elements that we see in the universe are broadly consistent with their formation in the Big Bang model. And another piece of evidence about the Big Bang is a thing called the cosmic microwave background radiation, which was predicted by theoretical models to exist. And if you like, you can think of this as being like a hangover from the Big Bang. The Big Bang was very large. It involved a huge amount of energy release. And that energy is still out there. Or that energy is out there on the edges of the universe, and it's still radiating back. So this was also detected too. And some other predictions of the model also fit observations. But of course, these are theoretical models. They work to explain things as we see them now, and they're always subject to changes and alterations. Let's just say one more thing about the cosmic microwave backwave radiation, which is kind of interesting. This was actually discovered by accident. The people who discovered this were not looking for it, even though they knew it was predicted. It's energy that comes from the outer edges of the universe, and it's the record of the initial massive energy release of the Big Bang. And the intensity of that radiation is not uniform. It varies in different parts, different directions from where we are across the universe. And that suggests that originally there was a heterogeneity in the early universe. In other words, matter was not evenly distributed and energy was not evenly distributed. So I think that's probably about as far as we wish to go with the Big Bang and the origin of the universe. Maybe we should come back now and think again about where we are in the universe as it is today. So let's have a look at the next slide. This one is slide 13. We're back to our photograph of a galaxy, which is actually the Andromeda Galaxy, but we're going to pretend it's the Milky Way Galaxy. The universe contains trillions of stars. The galaxy contains billions of stars. And they're very different. They're not all the same. They vary in their characteristics and they vary in their lifespans. Now, luckily for us, the Sun is a fairly long-lived type of star. It'll have a life of about 11 billion years. So it's close to about halfway through its life right now. Okay? The solar system and the Sun formed at the same time, and both of them have evolved over time. Where are we located? Well, we're about halfway out in one of the spiral arms of the Milky Way galaxy, which looks very much like the Andromeda galaxy, we think. So we're in the suburbs. We're not in the center of the galaxy at all. The galaxy may hold about 300 billion stars, and we're just one of them. We orbit one of them. So what about stars? They obviously contain most of the matter in the universe. Planets are inconsequential by comparison. Stars are not all the same. That's evident to anyone who looks at the night sky. So let's just look at this. This is an image we used before, probably as a background for a text slide, but this is a star cluster called M15 that's 33,000 light years from Earth. It's a Hubble telescope image. It's got about a million stars of various types. And you can see right away from looking at this that we see variations in their brightness, their luminosity. This is how much energy they're producing. And we also see variations in their color. And we can also see variations in their size, too. Some of these stars appear very, very tiny. They're little pinpricks of light. Others are obviously quite large by comparison. So stars vary a lot in their characteristics, in their colors, their surface temperatures, their sizes, their mass, dimensions. And they also vary in their lifespans, too. That's a function of the nuclear reactions that sustain them. So this is an important thing to think about, and we need to know a little bit about the population of stars that exist within the universe and where our star fits into that classification. So let's have a look at this. So, stars, the really big picture. Well, most of the matter in the universe is in stars, and we really don't know how many exist. Our Sun is a fairly common type of star. But we're going to take a quick look at what we know about other types of stars, because this has an important bearing on planetary systems. The kind of star that develops will have a bearing on the future of the planetary system, and it will also have a bearing on the capacity of the planetary system to develop life as well, because of things like radiation and also the lifespan of stars. Now, what we know about stars, pretty much entirely, aside from the Sun itself, comes from looking at the electromagnetic spectra of stars and various other methods that we use to figure out how far away they are, their size, and also to model the processes that go inside them. So we're going to go through some of these things kind of one by one so you can kind of understand how they're done. And we'll start out with the question of how far away are the stars? How do we know how far away a given star is? So now to the next slide. So what we're going to do now is conduct a little experiment. You can do this in your own room. Now, you already know that when we measure the distance to a star, we do it in units like light years or parsecs, and they're a very long way. But how do we do that? And how do we measure distances to the planets or the Sun? I mean, how do we know It's 150 million kilometers from the Earth to the Sun. Well, these methods basically all involve simple principles of geometry, and they're basically the same ones that we use on Earth for surveying in many respects. And in the end, they all go back to trigonometry, to examining triangles. So the way we're going to do this is by suggesting that you extend your arm and you raise a finger and position it in front of some object that's on the other side of the room. Then close your right eye and then close your left eye. What happens? What do you see? When you close your eyes, does that object remain in the same relative position? No, it doesn't. Okay, that object changes its relative position relative to the background that surrounds it. And this is the basis of the principle that we call parallax, which is a very important principle in understanding distances within the solar system and also within parts of the galaxy. So this is what we've demonstrated. Now, if you try that again and bring your finger really close to your face, just by the end of your nose, and try the same experiment, what happens then? What you should notice is that the shift in the apparent position of an object against a fixed background, in this case it might be the wallpaper on the edge of your bedroom or something like that, decreases with its distance from the two points of observation. If it's further away, the apparent displacement is less than when it's really close. So what this means is, if we can measure the apparent position of an object from two different locations, we can figure out how far away it is. And that's the principle of parallax. And that's what we use for surveying to a large extent. And this is what we use in astronomy as well. So let's move along to the next slide now. Okay, if you're a surveyor, what you do is you take a bearing on an object. Let's say you want to find out where a tree is on the other side of a river. Well, you take a bearing from one position, and then you move over, and you take a bearing from another position, which is a known distance from your first position. And those two bearings will give you angles. You know one of them is 90 degrees, and you know the other one is an angle you measure. And once you have that, you have a right-angle triangle. And as soon as you've got a right-angle triangle, then you have a means of figuring out distances, because you can use trigonometry. Okay, so Pythagoras, the principles of Pythagoras are amazingly important in all aspects of science, but especially so in astronomy. So that's how we do surveying on the surface of the Earth, and it's very similar to how we do surveying within the solar system too. So let's just have another look at this. Well, we have to figure out where things are in the sky. So when we measure the position of objects in the sky, we use angular coordinates from a given point of observation at a particular time. So we're going to be measuring in angles. We're measuring in degrees. There's 360 in a degree. Each degree is divided into what we call arc minutes. There's 60 of those. And each arc minute is divided into 60 arc seconds. So this is essentially the same as using latitude and longitude measures in geography. Latitude and longitude are essentially angular measurements from the center of the Earth to the surface of the Earth. Okay, and that's what we do with astronomy too, to locate where things are and to measure the distances between things. So the distance between two objects in the sky, or the distance between two positions in the sky, is measured as an angular distance. So let's have a look at the next slide now. So imagine that we have an object in space and we want to try and find out where it is. Well, if we were to observe it from two locations on either side of the Earth, at the same time, not necessarily in the same year, but at the same point in the Earth's orbit, its angular position will appear different. From position A, it will appear to be in A prime, and from position B, it will appear to be in B prime. So we know that that triangle that's made by A, B, and the object doesn't have a right angle in it, but if we divide it in two, we have two right angle triangles. So basically, if we can measure the apparent displacement of that object, okay, then we can figure out how far away it is by making two right-angle triangles from it. So that's a fairly easy process, and that's really how the principle of parallax works. And that's how it would work, for example, for checking on objects in the solar system. If you can measure them at two different locations on either side of the Earth, then you have a baseline of something like 12,000 kilometers. So you know the distance AB, you know half the distance of AB, and then you can calculate the distance to the object in space. So the principle of parallax really is not very complicated at all. It goes right back to Pythagoras and the time of ancient Greece. So just to emphasize that in detail, let's look at the next slide. So from A and B on opposite sides of the Earth, we have two different pictures. We have one that's seen from A and one that's seen from B. If we can measure the apparent displacement of the object of interest against that fixed background, that stellar background that we see out there, then we can calculate its distance. Now, in reality, there will be some very slight shifts in the stellar background too, but we can ignore those because the stars are so far away that they have very little impact on the movement of something within the solar system. They won't really affect that measurement to any significant extent. So a very simple principle applied from the Earth to the measurement of distances in space. So now let's have a look at the next slide. It gives us a way to measure the distance to objects, providing we know the distance between the locations of the measurements and the apparent displacement. And for most things in the solar system, we can get away with using different points on the Earth's surface, because then we have a baseline of about 12,000 kilometers. Now, if we want to do this for stellar measurements, we have a bit of a problem then, okay, because they're much further away. But if we take measurements that are taken 6 months apart, so the baseline then becomes 2 astronomical units, because we're on opposite sides of the sun, that's 3 × 10⁶ kilometers, all right, then we're going to see then that we can actually take measurements from stars to do this. Okay? So if you have a star that's 3.2 light years away from the Earth, it will have a parallax angle of 1 second, and that's where the term parsec comes from. Now, for very distant objects, when we get to the outer regions of the galaxy and out to other galaxies, the angles are too small. But there are other methods of estimating distance too that use spectroscopy. We won't get into these too much, but we do have methods of measuring distances for even greater distances away. So that's essentially how that principle works. And that's a very powerful principle, and it was applied for quite a long time before we had computers and a lot of sophisticated equipment or orbital telescopes or anything like that. So we have a pretty good idea of the distances to many of the stars within at least the portions of the galaxy that are near to us. So let's have a look at the next slide now. How big is an object? That's the next question now. If you see something in the sky, how can you figure out how big it is? How are you going to do that? Well, if you look at the moon and the sun, they're both about the same size in the sky. They measure about half an arc degree from one side to another, so 30 arc minutes. Okay? However, we know that they have very different distances from us. Now, the sun is 400 times further away from the Earth than the moon is, and it's actually 400 times larger than the moon. So once we know how far away something is, we do have a method of working out its real size from its apparent size. So in other words, if we know the distance to something, and we know how big it appears, then we can figure out how big it really is. Similarly, if we know how big something is, and we can measure its apparent size, we can figure out how far away it is. And this is the principle behind what's called the small angle formula, which is another important concept in astronomy. So let's look at that for a moment. Imagine you've got a distant object. You can measure its angular diameter. Now, if we know how big it is, we can figure out how far away it is. If we know the distance, we can calculate its size. The formula is quite simple because the angles are very, very small. But what it does depend on is having the ability to measure extremely small angular distances of objects. And that, of course, has improved greatly over time, particularly with the use of orbital telescopes, which makes it much, much easier. So that's another important technique that we have. So really, we have quite a lot of different ways for figuring out the sizes of things and the distances to things. They're summarized here. We have other methods now that we use within the solar system too. We can use radar ranging now from the Earth. We can actually bounce radar off objects and find out how far away they're directly. We find out how long it takes that pulse to get there and come back again. That's a very simple way of doing it. We didn't have that capability in the past. We have stellar parallax, which works very well. And then we have spectroscopic parallax, which is based on an understanding of the spectral characteristics of stars and their magnitude. And that basically is a variation of knowing how big and how energetic something is. And by measuring its apparent size and apparent energy output, we can figure out how far away it is. So we have a range of things at our disposal that are very useful. Can we use these things on stars? Well, some of them we can. We can estimate the size of some stars directly, but we have other means of looking at these problems too. So let's just move along now and look at the largest star that's known to exist, at least within our galaxy. This is a star called Betelgeuse, sometimes pronounced Betelgeuse. Well, the name actually comes from an Arabic word. I don't remember exactly what it means. And this is the ultimate supergiant. It's the largest star that exists within our galaxy that we know of. Okay? And it's big enough that we can actually measure its apparent size. Okay? And we can measure its distance too. Okay? Because we can use parallax. So we know that Betelgeuse is 600 times larger than the Sun. So that means that the outer edge of the star is actually much larger than Earth's orbit. Earth would fit inside the star Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse is a red giant. It's a particular kind of star. And eventually our Sun will become a red giant, but we don't have to worry about that for a good many billion years, at least another 6 billion years, I would say. Now, we can't use this method on smaller scales as easily because it's too hard to make those measurements, to actually measure the size of something, measure its angular size. It's too difficult to do that because they're too small. But we do have other ways of doing this as well. And one of these methods, of course, involves looking at the information from starlight. So what's coming, what we see as starlight when we look at the heavens there, is the energy that's coming from distant stars. Okay? So it's coming from a vast distance away, and it's also looking back in time too, because it may take hundreds of years or thousands of years to get to us. So every star, including the Sun, produces a large amount of electromagnetic energy. Now, the intensity of energy that comes from any object, including a star, will diminish with distance. Now, we know this intuitively. If the fire is really hot, if we move back to the other side of the room, it doesn't feel as hot. But there are rules that govern this. So, if we know how far away a star is, and we know how bright it is, we can estimate what we call luminosity, which means the energy that it yields. And that has a relationship, as it turns out, to size, to the mass of the star. We have other ways of estimating the mass of stars too. For example, looking at the periodicity of double star systems will tell us the mass of the stars within some constraints. The bigger the star, the more energy it produces. We also have the wavelength spectrum that comes from any object like a star. Star is emitting a range of wavelengths in the electromagnetic spectrum, and those wavelengths are characteristic of its temperature. And we know that because we have a theoretical basis for discussing that. We'll talk about that later on. And we also get compositional information from these measurements too. So by looking at information that comes from starlight, from electromagnetic radiation, we can break stars into different types of stars. And of course, what happens is that we see what we would call systematic patterns among stars. There's a clear relationship between mass, energy production, and all of these things. Okay? But what is the relationship between energy and distance? This is another important thing that we should touch on at this point. So let's look at the next slide. This is slide 28, and this shows what's called the inverse square law. Now, I'm sure that some of you have heard of this. It's a universal truth because it comes out time and time again in physics. Okay? So the energy output of a star or any object that's giving electromagnetic radiation follows what we call the inverse square rule. What that means is that if you double the distance from that object, the energy will diminish by a factor of 4, which is 2 to the power of 2. If you triple the distance, it will diminish by a factor of 9, which is 3 to the power of 2. If you quadruple the distance, it will diminish by a factor of 16, which is 4 to the power of 2, and so on and so on and so on. So the amount of energy that comes from a distant source can easily be converted into a measure of how far away it is if you know the amount of energy to begin with, or vice versa. So let's move along to the next slide now, which shows you some very well-known stars and demonstrates the difference in their appearance. So color and temperature among stars are closely related. So here's the constellation Orion. Orion contains the star Betelgeuse. It also contains Rigel, which is a very well-known blue star. It also has three stars in its belt that have a prominent blue color. And the next time you get a clear night, you can look at Orion and you'll see this a little bit on a clear night. Now, these color variations are not just random. They're a measure of the temperature of a star's surface. Okay? And blue stars are much hotter than red stars. And we know this very well because we know the relationship between wavelength spectra for from hot objects and their temperature. This is something we can investigate in the laboratory, so we know what that relationship is. So what does that tell us about the temperatures of stars? Well, here is a chart showing the temperatures of stars versus familiar colors. So a blue-white star, like Mintaka, which is in the belt of Orion, has a temperature of some 30,000 degrees Kelvin. That's a blue-violet star, sorry. A blue star like Rigel is down to about 20,000 degrees Kelvin. That's the temperature on the surface. White stars around 10,000. The Sun and Alpha Centauri, which is a relatively close star that's very similar to the Sun, has surface temperatures of the order of 6,000 degrees K. And as we go down through orange and red, we go down to lower temperatures. So Betelgeuse, despite its size, has a relatively low temperature of about 3,000 degrees Celsius. So there's also a link between the color of a radiating object and its total energy output. We know this. Hot objects emit more energy than cool objects. That's easy to discern. So white and blue stars are extremely energetic. They produce enormous amounts of energy. And they get this energy by fusing chemical elements, but they have to get it from a supply of those chemical elements. So they use up their fuel very quickly. So these very hot stars are burning their nuclear fuel, if you like, at far higher rates than a star like the Sun or some sort of a dwarf star like Barnard's star, for example. So there's a relationship between these things. And there is also, as it turns out, a relationship between these things and the size of stars as well. So let's just go to the next slide now. How big are stars? Well, we do have ways of estimating the size and mass of stars. We do this primarily through applying Newton's laws of gravitational to binary star systems, but we do have other methods as well. We can estimate some directly. And stars vary greatly in size. We already talked about Betelgeuse. It's huge. It won't fit on the diagram. It's so big. Okay? And here are some examples compared to the Sun. Okay, and you can see that on the scale of stars, the Sun is extremely small. Okay, the Sun fits within that small box that you see there. Okay, it's really very, very small compared to many stars. Sirius is a much larger star than the Sun. Aldebaran and all these other stars, they're huge in comparison to the Sun. But there are stars that are actually not much bigger than the planet Jupiter. Barnard's star is a dwarf. Okay, it's quite a small star. Proxima Centauri is a very small star. That's the closest one to us. Okay, so they cover a wide range of sizes. So the way you can think about it really is that stars are a bit like sand on a beach. You know, if you go to a beach, you'll occasionally find pebbles here and there, but the vast majority of things of the sand on a beach is small. They're small grains. And the same is true for stellar populations too. Although there are very big stars out there, most stars are pretty small. And the Sun is kind of mid-sized in terms of its size. Now, if you put all these things together, if you take the luminosity of stars, how bright they are, and you take their color and you plot them together, you find that there's a systematic trend. And this is a very important concept in stellar astronomy that's shown in the next slide. So to the next slide, which is slide 32, this is the thing that's called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, colloquially known as the HR diagram. So this is basically a plot of temperature versus luminosity, versus brightness. Okay? And what we find is that most of the stars form a trend. It's called the main sequence. So in other words, those that have red colors have low temperatures and low luminosity. Those that have white and blue colors have high temperatures and high luminosity. Now, we do see a bit of an exception to this. We see this region called the red giant region, which kind of comes off this trend. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later on. This is part of the stellar evolution of stars that actually resemble our Sun. Now, where does the Sun sit? Well, the Sun sits right in the middle of what's called the main sequence of stars, which is a correlation between temperature and luminosity. So, in other words, the brighter a star is, then the hotter its surface generally is and the greater the amount of energy that it's producing. But there is another trend that lies within this diagram that's probably more important. So let's just look at it again with a slightly different annotation and understand this. So here's the same thing simplified. This is the main sequence of stars. And what it shows is that when we try and figure out the size and the mass of stars in addition to their spectral properties, we find that the really big stars, okay, are the ones that are producing all the energy. So in other words, the main sequence of stars is defined almost entirely by the mass of stars. Hot, luminous stars are all much bigger than the Sun. Less luminous stars, for the most part, are much smaller than the Sun. But what does that actually mean in real terms? It's the pattern that we see, but what does this mean in terms of how we might approach stars from the perspective of planetary systems? So let's have a look at that. Well, basically, it tells us that there are good stars and bad stars. In general, these big stars, these hot stars that are extremely massive with blue and white colours, are very unsuitable candidates for planetary systems. Two reasons. The first is that they emit an awful lot of nasty radiation. They're emitting a lot of X-rays, a lot of gamma rays, a lot of stuff that's really generally bad for living things as we understand them. But more importantly, these massive hot stars actually have very short lifespans in terms of geological time or universal time, cosmological time. Most of them last less than 100 million years. Now that's a long time, but that's not very much time for evolution to take place when we consider that it took over 4 billion years for life to evolve to advanced species of so-called intelligent nature on the Earth. So these stars are going to run out of their hydrogen fuel quickly. They shift to more energetic fusion reactions that generate heavier elements, and then they blow up. They explode as novas or supernovas, depending on their size. Okay? And in this process, they create heavier elements. Now, on the other hand, if we look at dwarf stars, the little ones that are less massive and less luminous than the Sun would be, well, they're extremely long-lived. They could have lifespans that approach 100 billion years. They'll live as perhaps as long as the universe. Who knows? Okay? But they're very small. So that means that they're only going to have a very narrow zone around them that we would consider habitable if we define the presence of liquid water as being a necessary consequence for life to develop. So dwarf stars will live for a long time, but they have very small zones that would support conditions on planets that we would see as suitable for life. Also, many stars of all types are in binary systems in which they rotate or they orbit around one another. And these are considered to be rather unlikely candidates for stable planetary orbits. So luckily for us, the Sun is an intermediate kind of star. It's not too energetic, it's got a pretty long lifespan, and it's not part of a binary system. So we have relatively stable planetary orbits. And the other bit of good news is that stars like the Sun are probably very common on the scale of the galaxy and the universe. And we can represent this by looking at a simple pie chart. So the next slide now, this is slide 35, just a pie chart that shows you the classification of stars and their relative abundance from what we understand about our galaxy. So you can see that the massive stars with extremely high energy outputs are actually very infrequent. There's not many of them around. Okay? Red dwarfs are extremely common, stars that are less than one quarter of the size of the Sun. If we were to take stars that range in size from about half the size of the Sun to about twice the size of the Sun, we'd find that they make up about one third of all the stars in the galaxy. So that means that if there's 300 billion stars in the galaxy, there's 100 billion stars that resemble the Sun. Some of those are going to have stellar companions and may not be suitable for planets, but many of them will not. So that implies that there should be many, many, many planetary systems in the universe. And certainly within our galaxy, there should be many planetary systems. But do we have evidence for this? Can we say with confidence that other planetary systems do exist around other stars? Well, let's have a look. Well, there's plenty of evidence for it now. Until we had orbital telescopes, it was pretty difficult to answer this question. Orbital telescopes give us an amazing ability to look for planetary systems that exist around other stars. And later on we'll talk about the methods that can be used to detect planets in distant stars. And many of the ones that we've found are larger than the Earth, but we have found evidence of planets that resemble the Earth in size. So here's an artist's impression of some exoplanets that all exist in a star that's actually quite close. It's 33 light years away. L9859b is the smallest exoplanet yet confirmed. It's somewhere between Earth and Mars in its size. So that's an example of what's likely a terrestrial planet that resembles the Earth in some respects. Now, having said that, many of the exoplanets that we detect appear to be different in their characteristics to terrestrial planets. They're often very large, they're Jupiter-sized or larger than Jupiter, and they have orbits that seem to be rather different from those that we see in our solar system. We're not sure as yet if this is a bias in observation. We suspect that to be the case, but we need, obviously, to look further, look longer, and try and find more of these things so we can better understand their population. But the answer is yes, there's lots of planetary systems out there. So let's just quickly summarize with the next slide. Later on, we'll talk about exoplanets. The information we have now says that most exoplanets are not really like the Earth. They tend to be bigger, and in many cases, they orbit very close to their stars, so they're not in what we would consider to be habitable zones. But this is probably not a complete picture, because the methods that we're using are not as sensitive as would be ideal, and so it's very likely that we're just seeing the things that are easy to see, and we're missing many planetary systems that are simply not detectable just yet. So it's not really answered, and it's one of the most important questions to answer, really. Exoplanet research is one of the most important things that's going on at the moment. So that really concludes what I have to say about our position in the universe and introduce topics that come later on. So for a little while now, for a short period of time at the end of this class, we're just going to look at some information about the solar system and try and get some context of scale within the solar system, having given you some idea of the scale within the galaxy and within the universe. So let's take a look at the next slide. Okay, this is slide 38. It just says a modern view of our solar system. Now, obviously the sizes here, or the distances here, are not accurate. The sizes are not too far off the real sizes of planets. So we have 8 planets that we recognize within the solar system now. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Okay? We call the inner group the terrestrial planets, and we call the outer group the gas giant planets, sometimes the Jovian planets. There are some different words that are used for these things. Now note that Pluto has got a large X through it there. Pluto is no longer considered to be a planet for reasons that we'll discuss in a moment. Okay, so 8 planets are what we're dealing with within the solar system. However, the distances on this diagram are not representative at all. Okay? The planets in the solar system do move within what we call the ecliptic plane, more or less. They're not exactly within it, but they're very close to it, which is a plane that would also include the Earth and the center of the Sun. So they're all in the same plane. But we need to think about distances as well as relative sizes. So let's just move along and quickly discuss the fate of poor Pluto. Well, when I learned about the solar system, when I was a student, it had 9 planets, and Pluto kind of came to define the concept of being isolated and cold and far away. Well, 14, 15 years ago, Pluto was tossed out of the planetary club. It's now called a dwarf planet. A lot of people don't like that particular decision. They think that tradition should be maintained. What are the reasons for this decision? Why is Pluto no longer considered a planet? Well, really, there's 2 reasons. One is to do with its small size, because it really is pretty small, and there are lots of other objects in its general region that are actually the same size or bigger. So if Pluto's a planet, then we have to make all of these things planets too. And the other question is one of the fact that it hasn't really cleared its orbit. It hasn't really cleared its orbit of debris, and it also has a very strange orbit that in fact is inclined quite strongly to the ecliptic. And at times, Pluto is actually inside the orbit of Neptune. So it never really did fit all that well. And we now believe that Pluto is a representative of a large population of objects that exist beyond the orbit of Neptune. Things that are called Kuiper Belt objects or trans-Neptunian objects. So it's got a lot of company out there, and it's not really appropriate to single it out for planetary status. So let's go to the next slide now. Now, in the first slide about this, we showed the relative sizes of planets more or less as they are. In this one, we're going to show the solar system scales more or less as they are. So this gives us the solar system to a distance scale. So the Sun is in the middle, and the inner planets are essentially invisible. We can hardly see their orbits on this scale. Okay? Neptune's orbit, with 4.5 billion kilometers as its average orbital distance, is shown there at the edge of it. And we also show the plane of the ecliptic there. Okay? Note that Pluto has an orbit that's inclined to the plane of the ecliptic and at times is actually inside the orbit of Neptune. So that's an illustration of the actual scale of the solar system. So the terrestrial planets are an extremely small region in the center of the solar system compared to the absolute size of the solar system. So let's go to the next slide now. Back once again to this concept of the ecliptic plane. It is very important to understand this. It's called the ecliptic because in the old days it was the only area of the sky where eclipses could occur. Okay? It is a plane that includes the Earth's orbit and the center of the Sun. So it's a plane that includes those things. It's also more or less the plane within which all planets move within the solar system. Okay, there are some slight deviations from the ecliptic plane, but they're not very significant. And the ecliptic plane is a real place in the sky. Its position changes with the seasons, but it's always there. Okay, and this is a planetary alignment that you see here, where five planets are in fact all visible within the ecliptic plane, more or less. Okay, so they're all more or less on a line that connects the Earth to Saturn in this particular photograph here. They're not exactly aligned, but they're very close to being aligned. So the ecliptic is a very real feature in the sky, and it's a very real feature in the solar system. And any model for the solar system has to explain why this is, why the planets orbit more or less within a common plane. So now to our last slide for this presentation. I'm sure you're glad to hear that. If we look down on the ecliptic plane from the north, if you like, from the north of the Earth, okay, the north celestial pole, I should say, you'll notice that all planetary objects move around the Sun in an anti-clockwise direction. They revolve around the Sun in their orbits in an anti-clockwise direction. You'll also note, although it's not stated here, that all planetary objects within the solar system, with two exceptions, all major planetary objects also rotate on their axes in the same sense. They rotate in an anti-clockwise direction. The Earth orbits in an anti-clockwise direction, and so do most of the planets. The only exceptions are Venus and Uranus. Okay, Venus and Uranus have slow rotation in the opposite direction, which is another thing that needs to be explained in models for the solar system. Models for the solar system need to explain why it is that everything moves in the same direction and rotates in the same sense, but also need to explain why a couple of things are exceptions to the rule. You can also note from this that the actual orbits of the planets are generally near circular. Orbits are actually ellipses, but most of the planets have near circular orbits. So we'll leave it at that. That's a good introduction to some important features. One other thing that this slide does show here is the Kuiper belt. See all those little white dots around the edge of the solar system? Well, that's the large population of icy objects, including some that are as large as the former planet Pluto, that exists in the outer region of the solar system. So Pluto's one of those, we think, now, that's been deflected into a different orbit that now brings it inside the orbit of Neptune at one time or another. So that's it for this presentation. I think it's a little bit shorter than most of them are. If you move along now, you'll see the first of some summary slides. There are several summary slides that now summarize the main important points from this class. They're meant for you to look at. We're not going to go through them in detail in the podcast. You can look at them in your own time. They summarize some of the important points and provide references to various parts of the textbook if you're interested. So that's it. We're done with Module 3. We're getting there bit by bit. So we're going to reconvene in a little while. Radio System will be back on the air again to deliver Module 4. Module 4 is kind of an interesting module because in Module 4, first of all, we talk about the transition between astrology and theoretical astronomy, how we came to recognize the real arrangement that exists in the solar system. Because for a long time, we were operating under the delusion that the Earth was the center of the universe. And then in the second part of it, we're going to talk about planetary motions, and this is a really key aspect of the solar system. We're going to talk about orbits, we're going to talk about gravity, we're going to talk about how we use the laws of gravitation to find all sorts of information out about objects in the solar system. So, have a look at what you've learned today, have a look at the stuff that you've looked at in the first couple of modules. We've got a good start now on the language of planetary science, and when we come back, we'll start getting into some things in more detail. So thanks a lot, hope you have a good day.